Welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce Vesper, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading a new book called Tales of Al, The Water Rescue Dog, The Making of a Super Athlete by Lynn Cox. And if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles from The Genius of Dogs by the National Geographic. Our first reading today comes from The Tales of Al, The Water Rescue Dog by Lynn Cox. And the chapter is called Hot Chocolate and Beth. The hot summer sun set. The humidity was high, and the mosquitoes and black flies were humming as the moon rose over the slowly swaying pine trees along the edge of Snow Pond in Maine. It was time to escape from the heat and the weight of the world and to go swimming. I jogged from the family camp across the soft lawn in my swimsuit, with sweat sliding down the backs of my knees, hair sticking to my head, and swatting mosquitoes and breathing in black flies. I dove off the wooden dock into the water. A cool breeze as soft as whisper flowed over my body, and suddenly my hands cracked the surface of the inky black pond. Water exploded around me, and I felt myself gliding deeper and deeper into the blackness. My body was absorbed by the darkness, and the sounds above the water were extinguished. It was so peaceful. I only heard my heart beating and my breath rising in a slow stream of silvery bubbles. My body was suddenly light. I felt like I was floating in a dream. I was 7 years old and in a state of awe. There was something magical and thrilling about being in the pond at night when the colors of the world disappeared and the water and the land became shades of black, white, gray, and sparkling silver. Shapes, lines, textures, and light became more abstract. It was like stepping into a black and white photograph. In the darkness, I could merge with the water and the world and feel a deeper connection to both. My arms were outstretched, giving me balance, and my feet were dangling below. I sensed something moving around my feet, fanning the water, moving closer. Suddenly, I felt it nibbling on my little toe. I jumped, screamed, and kicked my feet at whatever it was, started sucking harder, and I tried to pull my toe from its mouth. And then I felt a swarm of creatures nibbling all of my toes. Fraught with fear, I frantically pulled to the surface, sprinted to the dock, curled my legs under my body, and held onto the side where my mom and dad were standing. "Something's biting my toes," I yelled. My mom laughed in her warm, musical voice and said the same thing happened to her when she was little. They were sunfish, small fish the size of her hand. They ate whatever they could fit into their mouths. She said there were larger fish, white and yellow perch, bass, pickerel, and eels that lived in the lake grass and near the lily pads, but they were not interested in eating toes. That made me relax, but not for long. Elizabeth, our 3-month-old Dalmatian, whom we called Beth, was standing near the dock's edge making sorrowful sounds. Her whimpers and whines were piercing the quiet night. In the darkness, the 332 black spots all over her white body were difficult to see. A glimmer of moonlight reflected in her soft brown eyes, and she looked afraid. She was panting. Her breath was hot on my face. I petted her to try to reassure her, but she would not be consoled. She knew we were going swimming and did not want to be left alone. She pulled away and protested with loud and anxious barks. She tucked her tail between her hind legs and crouched down. She wanted to be with the family. My mom jumped into the water and turned toward the shore. When Beth saw her dark form moving, she went wild and ran to the end of the dock. My mom scooped Beth up in her arms and carefully held her in the water. Beth started moving her tiny paws in the beginner's dog paddle, making a lot of splash. Mom guided Beth toward my dad, and when she was right in front of him, she let Beth go. He immediately caught Beth, praised her, and lifted her up to give her a hug. She surprised him by licking him all over his face. He laughed hard, a deep belly laugh, and for a few moments he held Beth and waited for her to catch her breath. My mom took a few steps back, and then my dad gently set Beth down in the water so she could paddle to my mother. They made sure that Beth felt safe, and she could trust them. My parents were teaching Beth to swim, the same way they taught my brother, sister, and me. My siblings joined us at the lake, and we swam with Beth. She wanted to keep going and going, but my mom said she had done enough for the evening. Beth was a little puppy, and this was a new exercise for her. My mom did not want her to overdo it, or she would be sore and overtired and not enjoying swimming. Before my mom lifted the puppy from the water, I asked if I could hold her for a minute and feel her swim. Mom made sure I had a firm grip on her, and Beth started paddling at a good pace. I felt her speed and power until Beth suddenly froze. A high, haunting, and beautiful sound burst through the air. The sound became suspended in the air and echoed across the pond. The darkness made it feel eerie. My dad whispered, "It's a loon, a large black water bird with red eyes and a pointed beak." He explained that loons are amazing swimmers and divers, and they build their nests in sheltered covers or coves on the islands near the center of the snow pond, places undisturbed by people. They chose areas where the water is clear, where they can see below the surface. In the shallows, they can hunt for the salamanders and frogs, and they can hold their breath for 15 minutes and dive up to 50 meters underwater to catch small fish. Their feet are large, and they use them like flippers. The loon was calling his mate. He hooted. A few moments later, with a long, wavering call, she answered. He replied. He was close to us, his voice louder than hers. He called again, homing in on her plea, trying to find their nest. She directed him with a long, mournful wail. Their calls and answers started to overlap, and the pine beech and maple trees rimming the shore created a natural amphitheater, amplifying the cascading birdsong. We saw a flash of silver and heard a large splash. Beth jumped. She was startled but not afraid. The loon surfaced only 10 meters away, moonlight reflecting off his silvery feathers necklace, and made it glow and flicker as he paddled cautiously past us. The female continued calling with long, loud wails. Her mate answered and suddenly flapped his wings hard and fast and lifted his heavy body off the rippled pond. She continued making her haunting calls and hoots until they were in their nest. My dad explained that loons were special to the Algonquin Indians, who believed that the birds carried divine messages. The Algonquins were right. We can see the mystery, wonder, and magic in the natural world through loons and their exquisite songs. Beth was starting to get chilled. She was shivering in my hands. My mom took her from me and carried her out of the water. My dad gently dried her with a towel. Beth loved the feeling of the towel brushing against her skin, and when he dropped his face near hers, she struck her wet nose onto his cheek. He laughed and carefully tried to dry her ears, making sure that there was no water remaining in the canals. When my dad set Beth down, she wiggled and whipped her body against his long leg, wagged her whip-like tail, and then sprinted across the lawn and ran into a large circle around us. We were a swimming family, and she seemed to love swimming as much as we did. The night had become chilly, so we hurried into the camp where my grandparents were waiting. We crowded around the black iron wood stove and felt the warmth radiating across our bodies. Our muscles eased and relaxed. The burning wood smelled so good. The smoky fragrance of sweet maple, earthy oak, and spicy pine filled the kitchen. My grandfather Arthur asked us to step back so he could lift a burner off the stovetop and feed more wood to the fire, so my grandmother Elaine could heat some milk and make us hot chocolate. Inside the stove, the wood glowed bright orange and yellow and crackled. Sparks flew as my grandfather added split logs to the hole in the top, and the room gradually became warmer. A few minutes later, my grandfather handed me a cup of steamy hot water and chocolate. Carefully, I took it in both hands and drank it. The chocolate was sweet and creamy and rich. The drink tasted delicious and warmed me up after the cool evening swim. Dog tired, Beth curled up on the soft rug made by my grandmother. It was a braided rug, and I loved it. I asked her how long she spent working on it, and she said 3 years. That seemed forever to me. She assured me that 3 years was not a long time, and that as I got older, the years would fly by. But time was always precious. She hugged me, and I think to make sure I would remember that moment. She was warm and soft and smelled delicate, like the lilies of the valley. You work on things you love. That makes you happy and helps you bring beauty into the world, she said. Finishing my hot chocolate, I studied the rug carefully. Grandma Elaine used wool fabric, strands of turquoise, bright blue, forest green, heather gray, soft orange, and butter yellow. She braided them with her gentle hands into beautiful patterns and shaped the braids into a large oval. The colors and patterns she created in the rug made it a work of art. I liked to lie on it and look at the different color combinations and feel the soft braids. My grandmother glanced at Beth. I thought she would be saying something about the wet dog lying on her beautiful rug. She did not like dogs, having been bitten by a cocker spaniel when she was a young child. They still terrified her. She never walked near a dog, and if one got close to her, she ran away. My mom has also been bitten by a cocker spaniel when she was a child. Sometimes fear travels through generations and stays, but my mom did not accept a fear of dogs. She discovered she could not pet a sleeping dog, realizing that it startled them, and she never did it again. She now loved dogs. I got down on the floor and sat on the braided rug with Beth near the warmth and light of the window and the wood stove. She placed her head in my lap so I could rub her velvety black ears and read to her and to myself. She loved mysteries, and I did, too. It was probably the way I read to her. She liked hearing the clues and wanted to know where the bones were buried. When I talked to her, she seemed to know that I was discussing the clues. She looked like she was considering what I told her. She let me rest my head on her back. Sometimes Beth rolled over, and I petted her soft pink belly while reading to her. When she fell asleep, her eyes twitched beneath closed eyelids. Yet her black nostrils flared, and her breathing quickened, and she whimpered. Her spotted legs extended above her body and contracted as she ran through the air and dog paddled in her dreams. Beth would stay with me as long as I was reading. When I carried my book upstairs to bed, she snuggled in beside me, and we would read until the lights went out, and then I would turn on my flashlight. We would read together into the wee hours of the night, when the world was peaceful and the words were more magical. I could imagine new things about life, and Beth would move into the pillow, and we would be cheek to cheek. There was nothing quite as wonderful as reading a good book beside a good dog. It was not long before Beth was swimming with us in the pond. She loved being in the water. If she saw the family in the pond, she would tear down the lawn, run across the dock, and leap in with a huge splash. She would swim to each of us and herd us together, but she was more focused on my mom. Maybe it was because she knew my mom filled her food bowl, but I think it was something deeper. They had a special connection. They loved each other. It was easy to see in that way that they looked at each other in their eyes, the way Beth prodded my mom with her nose and wagged her tail to get her attention, and the way my mom stroked Beth's head with adoration. Beth watched over my mom. She was happiest in her company. When my mom went grocery shopping, Beth hopped in the red Buick station wagon, sat in the passenger seat, and stuck her head out the window with ears flapping and intense brown eyes watching for anything that might pose a danger. Toward the end of the day, when my mom took a break and stood by her easel to work on her oil paintings, Beth lay near the door by her feet. The room filled with the spicy smell of turpentine and the sounds of Beth's long and steady breathing and of my mom's palette knife as she scraped short and rapid strokes across the canvas. Often she paused to check her progress and petted Beth to reassure her that all was well. When my mom finished painting for the day, Beth's coat would be speckled with cadmium blue, red, yellow, ochre, sap green, Payne's gray, and colors my mom blended on her palette. Beth was always vigilant when my mom was in the water. My mom floated vertically with her arms extended as naturally as a water lily. She was at home in the water. Her breaststroke was easy, with powerful pulls and kicks and long glides. Her backstroke smooth, and her head was relaxed, and her freestyle was graceful and efficient. Only small splashes of white water rose from her hands as they entered the water, and her hair was strong and steady, and her pull was very powerful. Her glide along was long, and her flutter kick was just enough to keep her balanced in the water. Beth did not understand that my mom was okay. She would sprint along the dock and leap into the pond, circling her and trying to grab my mom's wrist in her mouth to pull her toward the shore. Mom would say, "No, Beth," and gently push her away. But Beth was determined. She would chase my mom, but my mom would swim away from her fast. Maybe this was something in Beth's genes. Dalmatians are bred to be firehouse dogs, to lead horses and firemen to fire and to protect them. That instinct was strong inside Beth, and she felt she needed to protect my mom. Our family swims in the snow pond with Beth became one of my favorite things. I also love to eat black raspberry ice cream with her. I got the top of the cone and she got the crunchy bottom. Part of my love for swimming came from Beth. My parents encouraged my connection with Beth because I liked to wander and explore, and they thought that having our dog with me would make me safe. My mom and dad let Beth give me her middle name, giving a life that filled me with the sense of responsibility and awe, and it made me feel like I was growing up. I spent months considering what to name her, holding her spotted wiggly body in my hands, feeling her tiny heartbeat, her warmth, the softness of her fur, her ears and her body, and seeing the brightness in her eyes. I knew there was something miraculous about this little puppy. I tried to think of a name that would describe her spirit. She was like a purple crocus blossom that emerged from an island of ice along a long, frigid New England winter. She was strong and vital, but also delicate and exquisite. "What do you think of Elizabeth Crocus Cox?" I asked her. Beth did not react. Crocus did not sound right. I wondered if there was another word for it. Searching through dictionaries and thesauruses, I couldn't find anything. I finally created a name and tried it on her. "Do you like the name Snowflower?" I asked. Beth wagged her tail fast, jumped up, put her paws on my shoulders, and licked across my face. By naming her, I felt a stronger connection to her. I trained Beth to lie near my feet under the table during supper, and at the end of the meal, I snuck her treats. She ate whatever I gave her without jiggling the tags on her collar or making a sound. My mom served the family liver once a month because my parents believed the high iron content of the filter organ was good for us. Attempting to disguise the strong flavor, my mom sautéed bacon and onion in a heavy cast-iron frying pan to add sweetness and smokiness to the liver. She served it with the onion and bacon on top, with a side of mashed potatoes. The texture of the liver was spongy, and its flavor infused the bacon and onions, so everything tasted chalky and metallic. I was told I had to eat it, but I couldn't. Beth always saved me. She placed her head in my lap and devoured the liver piece by piece and nudged me with her wet nose, requesting more. We were best friends, exploring the woods, splashing in streams, wandering through fields of high grasses, catching bugs, eating wild blueberries, and watching gray squirrels with some of the best things we did during the day. And at night, when hot, humid air collided with cold air, storms often rolled over Snow Pond, and thunder shook the camp so much that my grandfather said that the people were bowling in heaven. Sitting on the floor beside Beth, I wrapped my arm around her back, and we listened to the rumbling and crashing thunder and watched the brilliant blue flashes of lightning zigzagging across the inky black sky. Pouring rain streamed down windows, blurring the view of the lawn, trees, and pond. Roaring wind buffeted the camp. Waves shattered across the pond. We were immersed in the storms, and Beth was a brave dog. None of this bothered her. It was exciting for her. We sat together, feeling the energy being unleashed around us. In the morning after a storm, when the pond was capped with a thin, silvery layer of cool water and the air was light, sweet, and fresh, Beth dog paddled beside me, her head even with mine. We raced between the dock and the shore, swam around my grandparents' property to neighboring camps and farther up the pond to watch frogs on lily pads catching bugs. It was fun. And because of her, I fell in love with swimming and with dogs. That was why many decades later, I was transfixed what I saw on my computer screen. And next week, we'll find out just exactly what it was that Lynn found on her computer screen in Tales of Al, The Water Rescue Dog, The Making of a Super Athlete by Lynn Cox. Our next reading comes from the National Geographic book called Understanding Our Best Friends, The Genius of Dogs. Big Hearts. Consider what our ancestors did not have when they first domesticated dogs. There were no other domestic animals, no agriculture, no written language. Tools made of metal did not exist. As best as we can tell, humans didn't even have fixed settlements yet. Life was radically different, but already we had dogs. Our lives had been intertwined ever since. On to their wolfish heritage, the basic body plan, social predisposition, intelligence, and acute senses, people added traits, both physical and mental, producing animals suited to labor and companionship, and what extraordinary companion dogs are. In recent years, science has illuminated dogs' mental lives in fascinating ways, how evolution shaped their habits of mind as pack animals, the way their emotional development resembles our own, and how a capacity for love may literally be their defining quality. These insights will shape how we understand and treat them. Modern pet-loving cultures are the latest stage in relationships that have evolved for millennia. Dogs have occupied ever larger parts of our hearts and homes. Cultural institutions have followed suit. Most fundamentally, many people now think of dogs as furry kin. In the spirit, although it's still legal customs for dogs to be owned, this volume will eschew the language of ownership. Technically, dogs might be property, but that term doesn't do justice to who they really are. Rather than referring to a dog's owner, we can instead call them a dog's person. We belong to them as much as they belong to us. And with a deeper understanding of who dogs are, we can better return their love and their trust. Becoming dog. A few thousand years ago, the ancestors of sweet, cuddly pooches were wolves as large as adult humans. It's an evolutionary journey as extraordinary as dogs are wonderful, and although its earliest steps are shrouded by the mists of time, did wolves scavenge around Stone Age settlements, join us as equals on hunts? The practice of breeding, especially during the past several centuries, has produced a creature possessed of more physical variety than is found in any other species. Dogs are not technically a species, of course. They're still formally considered a subspecies of Canis lupus, a part of a lineage that dates to a time shortly after dinosaurs went extinct. Canis lupus familiaris still has many wolfish traits, including a predilection for pack life, although the pack habits of free-ranging dogs, whose numbers actually dwarf those of our domestic pets, underscore how the primal character has changed. The same goes for their psychology and physiology. Dogs inherited an incredibly acute sense of smell. Indeed, scent may be as fundamental to dogs' experience of life as vision is to our own and heightened hearing, along with the vision that in some way surpasses our own and in others comes up short. When it comes to perceiving us, though, understanding our communication and reading our moods, dogs are unique. They have evolved to become our best friends. And so begins the reading from the magazine, The Genus of Our Dogs, Understanding Our Best Friends by National Geographic. We're coming to the conclusion of Animal Companions, but before we sign off, I'd like to read you a few statements from various people about animals in our lives. This particular statement is by Winston Churchill. Dogs look up to you. Cats look down on you. Give me a pig. He looks you in the eye and he treats you as his equal. So says Winston Churchill. Now, Oliver Gasperitz says that a fish tank is just interactive television for cats. And anybody who doesn't know what soap tastes like never washed a dog. And that's according to Franklin P. Jones. Pat Jones says, cats can work out mathematically the exact place to sit that will cause the most inconvenience. And finally, this particular case study comes from Arizona State University. To test how labels shape the way people perceive dogs, researchers led by Lisa Gunter, a psychologist at Arizona State University, showed videos of dogs at a shelter to 51 people. Half the dogs were identified by shelter staff as pit bulls. The other looked just like them but received other breed designations. When viewers watched without knowing the dogs' breeds, they found that the pit bulls were far more appealing, but when videos included breed information, the pit bull's attractiveness dropped sharply. Next, the researchers had a shelter in Florida remove breed identifiers from their dogs, and pit bull adoptions jumped up by nearly 25%. And I can attest to that because we have a pit bull, and that pit bull is called Kubwa, and she's delightful and loves chasing her ball. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you enjoyed the readings, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce Vesper for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be happy, everyone. Be well. Be healthy. Bye-bye.